Cover last week. It changes in tone from everything that was shared last week. So we're picking up where we left off and trying to make ourselves understand something of what it is that the Apostle Paul is pointing to at this point. What's going on here? Let me read from verse 9. So he's just been do you remember we'd said at the beginning of chapter 12, it's like reaching the peak. We're looking out. We suddenly have the ground in front of us. We can see where we've come from, and we can see maybe also where we're headed. Because from this point on, the apostle is all about trying to land. Well, so what? What do you do with this? How do you work this out? How do you work this into your life? What are you supposed to do with this stuff? How do you make your way through this country that is life in front of you? So let me read then his thoughts on what that means from verse 9. It'll be on the screen behind me, but if you want to use one of these pew Bibles, it's on page 1139. You'll find the text that I'm reading in the second column. It says this: love must be sincere. Hate what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in love. Honor one another above yourselves. Never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor, serving the Lord. Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. Share with the Lord's people who are in need. Practice hospitality. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Mourn with those who mourn. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited. Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Do not take revenge, my dear friends, but leave room for God's wrath, for it is written, "It is mine to avenge. I will repay," says the Lord. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Well, I think one thing that we're absolutely not sure of these days is lifestyle instruction, right? The whole of social media is awash with it, isn't it? You can go into a bookshop, you find whole columns, you know, whole bookshelves in a bookshop full of the lifestyle guides, you know. So you want to be fitter, thinner, cleverer, nicer, more successful, a better leader, earn more money, save more money, have a better, healthier lifestyle. You've got it. It's there. You want to improve anything from improving your squash game to learning a new language to, you know, fighting off dementia or whatever it is. You've got everything. And the time to take action, we're all told, is now, right? You have to do something today. Don't just wait for it to happen. Like, you know, if you want this to happen, what's this whole thing about, what do people talk about? Manifesting, you know, this idea that if you think it, you will be it. Whoa, I wish that could happen to me. Doesn't quite work that way, I don't find. But there's a lot of... there's a lot of energy that goes into this. If you look at TikTok, goodness me, a lot of those little videos are directed towards improving and changing and motivating you to make changes in your life. Instagram, it's like full of it. That's it. If I stop getting chainsaw videos or whatever it is that you are plagued with before you end up getting the things you actually want. We have lots of guides for managing life. Lots of guides for managing life. And in a sense, I wonder if, like this passage that I've just read for you, these 12 verses that contain 24, you might find a different count if you really go for it, but I felt that some of them were connected to others. So 12 verses that contain 24 imperatives, of which 6 are negative, 18 are positive. You know what an imperative is: sit there, do this, move in this direction. They're very much almost like commands, right? Words that say, this is what you've got to do. This is the way you do it. This is the kind of thing that you're going to see in those videos and in those books that you find on lifestyle. If you really want to make progress, this is what you need to do. Now remember, the Apostle Paul, writing to the Romans, he's not wanting to replace one law for another law. He's not saying, this is the way that you please God, is the way that you affirm, the way that you gain your identity in God, that's not what he's saying. He's not saying you have to do this to be this. What he's saying is, because you are this, this is what you do. Do you get the difference? So he's not telling people that they have to do it to be something, to be loved, to be cared for, to be acknowledged by God. But he's saying, because you are loved by God, because you are acknowledged by God, because of who you are, this is the way that you could live. There's a difference. It's not law, it's grace. It's saying, here is an opportunity that you now have that you didn't used to have. You can be a different sort of person. So I think this is an amazing opportunity for us to open up a lifestyle guide that helps us actually with something that is manageable, because that's the issue. Most of the time, these lifestyle guides, you know what? It just don't work for me. There's too much. It's too big a hill. But here in this case, it's like saying, no, you're already this. You just need to live it out. Just put this into practice. This is already who you are if you just let it out now. And these are, I think, the guide that links all of these points together. I don't know if you've got this in the scriptures that you're using, but it says at the top of mine, love in action. And the title that I want to give this is, it is guiding us towards a life of love. These are instructions for living a life of love. And I've broken it down into 8 qualities. So these different things that he says to do or not to do, I've broken them into 8 qualities that make up a life of love. And the first quality that makes up a life of love is sincerity. Love must be, he starts off, sincerity. It's a must. Like, it's not a maybe. You have to be sincere. People can see through things. If you're half-hearted or if you're not real about it, people can see that unreality. So love must be, and what he's saying there is, it's got to be real. Like, you can't pretend to love things or people. You can't pretend to care for them. You have to be real in this. It must be sincere. And that sincerity has certain consequences. It means that sincerity will mean that you hate what is evil. Like, because evil is going to be working against love. And you're going to cling to what is good, And clinging, I love that kind of clinging is that big hug or a real good grip on something. Clinging, and it's that I'm not letting go, right? Cling to what is good. And sometimes, you know, it's a bit like we've ventured into some white water, that we've gone into a fast-flowing river, and we didn't realize just how fast-flowing it was, and we kind of get in, it's threatening to sweep us away, and we've got to grab a hold of something and hang on to it, and that's like it is in life. We've got stuff washing past us that would wash us into things that aren't great. So we've got to hold on to what is good as part of this sincerity in love. And the working out of that sincerity comes in honoring one another above yourselves. That takes a little bit of thought. That takes a little bit of working out. What does it mean to honor someone above myself? You know, I'm pretty good at taking care of myself. How do I then make sure that I'm taking care of others? Not just as good as I'm taking good of care of myself, but above. That's the first quality, sincerity. The second quality is energy. And I'm looking here at verse 11. Never be lacking in zeal. And zeal speaks to me of a kind of internal energy that comes, that marks a life. He talks about spiritual fervor in the next line. And we're a bit cagey with spiritual fervor, right? Because we can see that spiritual fervor often has bad outworkings in the world. When people think that they're so right that you're wrong, and they're so right that their right is going to be imposed upon you, that's not a good form of spiritual fervor. But that's not the kind of spiritual fervor he's talking about. He's talking about what's driving you, what's pulling you, what's energizing you? What keeps you going on those days when it's hard to keep going? And there's a kind of commitment that he speaks about here, because in verse 11 he says, you shouldn't be lacking in zeal, you need to keep spiritual fervor, and then he puts it into a package that says, serving the Lord. There's a guideline. There's something that's always going to, that's a guide that's going to keep your spiritual fervor in the right place. Because if you're serving the Lord, that those railway lines are going to keep you going in the right direction. You're not going to go off at a tangent in some wrong direction. You know, energy and fervor, especially in religious practice, is often characterized by frustration, by impatience, and by a kind of a sense of, you know, just loyalties being pulled one way and another. Instead, in verse 12, he paints a picture of what this energy should look like. He says, you should be joyful in hope. Oh boy, after a week like we've just had, do we need hope? We do. You know, and there's all sorts of grim predictions, isn't there? I've carried on, cut down on my news watching because it depresses me. And yet I can't help but confront it. I can't help but confront the drones that landed in Poland, or the huge political demonstrations that took place in London yesterday, or what's gone on in America this last week. And there's a little bit of me that loses a bit of hope. And I need to be joyful in hope, because the world needs hope, but it also needs joy at this time. There's a lot of negative feeling, and we need to find some positives here. And that spiritual energy channeled in the right way in God's service enables us to be joyful in hope. And then it talks about being patient in affliction. Well, I don't know about you, but that's not me. Trying to figure out what does it mean to kind of endure stuff that's not good. And that spiritual energy can help you do that and can be what you need at that right moment. And then he talks about being, well, the other way that this shows up, so rather than frustration, joy, rather than impatience, patience, and rather than disloyalty, faithfulness in prayer. Faithful in prayer. Okay, so he's pointing away to something that maybe most of us wouldn't even think of as something that's doing anything at all. What is prayer? Prayer is taking our conversation to God and taking the thoughts and requests of our lives to God. And he's saying, be energized in that. That's what the world needs. That's what people need. That's what you need. Take time to talk to God and be faithful with that. Hospitality is the third thing, the third quality that he picks out here, because in verse 13, he talks about sharing with God's people who are in need, and then practice hospitality, share with others. And I like the way that he talks about it being a practice. You might not think you're very good at this. Well, that's okay. I'm not very good at lots of things. But if I keep practicing it, if I keep working at it, then I might actually get better. So do the little that you can do and work up from there. You know, if you find it difficult to share, buy someone a coffee or take time to maybe just give them a bit of time by actually practicing giving. Practicing sharing, practicing hospitality, you will work this quality up in your life. Hospitality. So sincerity, energy, hospitality, three qualities. Fourth one, grace. Look at verse 14. That's where I get that from. Grace. Bless those who persecute you. Wow, this one's a toughie. This is really, really difficult. Bless and do not curse. My friends, I've said this before, and I'm going to say it again. You know if you're making headway as a follower of Jesus in how it is that you can treat the people, not who are your friends, but the people who are really, really tough in your life. The people who actually cause you hassle, the people who are looking to take you down, the people who are always out to get you. How you treat those people is a mark of your discipleship, of how close you're following Jesus. We know that we're making progress as disciples of Jesus, as people whose lives are modeled on who Jesus was, when we can forgive and love our enemies. And one way of forgiving and loving our enemies is not cursing those who persecute us, but blessing them. That's a really, really tough call. And I can't, it can't be imposed. It's not something that comes overnight. We're going to find it hard. But it stops things getting bitter and broken inside. It really does. So it's important. We'll come to what we do. It's not those people get away with stuff, right? Because we're going to come to that in a moment. They don't get away with it, but our attitude to it changes. So grace is the fourth quality. The fifth quality is consideration. Rejoice with those who rejoice, mourn with those who mourn. Get the tone right? Not like in the Bible we're told in the Old Testament about a guy called Job who was afflicted and he went through a time of great physical, emotional, and mental suffering. In fact, it was spiritual as well because he felt isolated from God. And he was an actual picture of depression, misery, and physical frailty, and he had friends that gathered around him to try and support him, but they ended up like saying, Job, what's wrong with you? You know, what have you done that's so bad? Why is God treating you in this way? Surely there's something that you've done. They got the tone completely wrong. So we call them Job's comforters because they weren't comforting at all. They were wretched, horrible, They need to leave the room. And when they did, God spoke and Job felt a ton better. Because we're told here that we are to, verse 16, live in harmony with one another. Getting their tone right is so important because that makes everything sound an awful lot better. It's the fifth quality. The sixth is humility. Don't be proud, second half of verse 16. Be willing to associate with people of a low position. That's people who can't do anything for you. Right? Like we're so good at getting alongside people who can do things for us, being nice to them, trying to persuade them that they can help us and that by helping us they help themselves. But no, be willing to associate with people of low position, people who can't do anything for you. Don't be proud, don't be conceited. Live a life of humility. That is how you live a life of love. Sincerity, energy, hospitality, grace, consideration, humility, and then community. Be careful, verse 17, the second half of that, be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. 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 Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. We live in a really, really judgmental age, don't we? I mean, you know, just look at the last week in the headlines and look at what goes on in social media. People are judged for all sorts of things. So we've got to try, got to work at things, doing what's right. Not just in my eyes or your eyes, but in the eyes of everyone. Trying to do what is right. And you know, if you live right, it does speak to everyone. And one of the ways of doing that, it goes on to say, if it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Wow, there's a toughie. Because there are people in my life, and I'm sure in yours, who are difficult to live at peace with. And we need to try hard to live at peace, to walk away from those moments of conflict, to be peacemakers, to be people that bless others in that way. And a life of love is a life not lived in isolation, but lived in community, lived together with others. And finally, my eighth point that I kind of want to find in these verses is a life of love is a life that's marked by trust in God. Here's a way of perhaps explaining how it is that we can live in grace, that how we can bless those who persecute us, because we trust in God. We don't take revenge because God is the one who's going to sort everything out. He's going to sort everyone out. He's going to hold people accountable for what they have done. I am not God. I can't judge things correctly. I can't see everything there is to see. I don't know why this person is acting in this way or what has driven them to this point, but God knows, and He's going to be the judge of everything and work everything out and call everyone to account with just the right level of accountability, including me, by the way, and you. So I can trust in God, because if I do trust in God, if I leave room, as the apostle says, for God's wrath, for that's God's, that's not His, that's not anger like my anger or yours, that's God's absolute determined opposition to everything that works against His purposes. God is determined to sort that all out. And if I can leave room for that, leave that to God, it allows me to take care of my enemies. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. If he's hungry, I can feed him. I can actually do that from a genuine heart because I'm living a life of love. Because I know God's going to take care of this enemy of mine or this person who's persecuting. I can trust in God to sort that out. So eight qualities that mark a life of love. I wonder, as you've been listening to me outline them this morning, who does this sound like? Sunday school question, isn't it?
Jesus.
Look at Matthew 5 and 6, and you'll find something that's very similar to what the Apostle Paul is writing here. He didn't know those passages, perhaps at that time it hadn't been written down, and yet he would have known of Jesus' teaching on the Sermon on the Mount. And this sounds very similar to what Jesus said to his disciples gathered around him on that mountainside. It sounds like Jesus. It sounds like the things that Jesus said. Who does this look like, this life that's marked by sincerity, energy, hospitality, grace, consideration, humility, community, and trust in God? Well, it looks just like Jesus. It looks just like Jesus. Discipleship, this journey of faith that we're called to, it's not just about some internal belief, right? It's about internal beliefs being worked out in all of life. We're invited to become part of a new family, a new way of living. And it's an amazing opportunity because actually you will get the energy that you need to do it. It's not just, oh, try this and work it out for yourself. No, the Holy Spirit is going to come and help you be this, to do all these things, because that's what Jesus wants. He knows we can't do this on our own, but we can do it with his help. Discipleship, this journey of faith, is becoming more like Jesus. And I wonder if maybe something you could do with this over the next week or so is come back to what I've shared this morning. Come back to this passage, Romans 12, 9 to 21. Pick one thing that speaks to you and work it out. Start working it into your life. Our journey, our calling, is just like Jesus. Verse 21, not to be overcome by evil. Jesus went to the cross. Evil poured down its hatred upon him, its consequences upon him. Those nails were driven in, yes, by the soldiers there, but they were allowed to be driven into him because Jesus went to the cross bearing the weight of my wrongdoing, your wrongdoing, the wrongdoing of the world. This is what we believe as Christians. Jesus died, in a sense, overwhelmed by my sin, by the sin of the world, placed upon him. But he was not overcome by evil. He was not overcome by evil. 3 days later, Jesus rose from the dead. This is the incredible message of Christianity. This is what we hold on to. Jesus rose from the dead. He died for my sins and for yours. He paid the price. He wanted to show us God's love. He wanted to demonstrate how we could know God personally. But he was not overcome by my evil and yours and the evil of the world and everything that was put upon him. Instead, he overcame evil with good. His goodness was enough to pay the price of my failures, my disobedience, my errors, mistakes, and deliberate turnings away. Yours too. And to provide a way to live this life of love that he beckons us towards. We're going to sing now, because in a moment we're coming to what we call communion. The Lord's table is sometimes called that. And there are elements there, just simple tiny bits of bread and some grape juice that we pass around to remember that Jesus' body was broken for us, that Jesus' blood was shed for us, that Jesus has become for us the gateway, the means, the energy that we require to live a different kind of life. And he's provided us with everything we need for a life of godliness and contentment. Wow. And so as we go into this time, we'll be remembering Jesus, but we'll be thinking, and I invite all of you to think really, really carefully, right? You're all very welcome to take a piece of bread, and you're all very welcome to take a glass of wine, but it doesn't mean anything to you. It's just going to be a thing to do unless you really think for a moment and stop for a moment and actually understand that in doing this, we're sharing the body of Jesus in some sense. It's just a piece of bread. But we're sharing, in a sense, the fact that he has gathered us into his body. He's wanting us to live a life of love to reflect who he is to the world. And he's given us his strength, his energy, his life to do just that. So I invite you all to come to that point, but to do it thoughtfully and carefully and prayerfully. And we've got a moment to reflect on that as we sing a song just now that invites us to come to the altar. Let's stand together as we sing.